Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired and educated on all things writing, editing and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my Patreon page over at patreon.com. For supporting the production costs of the podcast each month, you'll receive additional conversations with each week's guest. You'll receive a personal thank you from me and, of course, a shout out on the show. It's an exclusive community of writers who, for only $3 a month, want to support the show and ensure it continues. If you'd like access to additional material and a shout out on the show, go to patreon.com/EmmaDesi. So come on over to patreon.com/EmmaDesi where I'll be waiting to welcome you into the family. Okay, let's dive in to today's episode. Mark Grenside, born and raised in London, began his working career straight out of school at Lloyd's of London, specialising in kidnap, ransom and extortion insurance. At 25, it was time for a career change and to dump the suit and tie, so he started his media career working for Jim Henson and the Muppets. From that moment on, he has been involved in entertainment and in nearly every aspect of it. He went on to create and produce several television series and miniseries, and at the same time he started a music management company, launching million-seller artist Naina Cherry. In 2004, he arranged the $250 million buyout of the Hallmark Channel International, which was then successfully sold to NBC. He returned to producing a number of movies and miniseries. But more recently, he has morphed into a serial entrepreneur and is now a co-founder of seed-to-shelf CBD producer Dragonfly Biosciences and a founder in two separate digital companies. In addition to his love of cooking, an unhealthy amount of time and money is lavished on a collection of classic cars that he has raced all over the world. He enjoys risk and has parachuted in New Zealand, scuba dived in the Pacific, hang glided in the Himalayas, and even tobogganed down the Cresta Run. In nearly every case, chasing after his wife, who he says is utterly fearless. Fallout was Mark's debut novel and was published in May of 2020, and he's now writing the follow-up entitled The Bastion. In addition, he writes a humorous blog with subscribers in more than 40 countries. He has two grown sons, two daughters-in-law, three grandchildren, and now lives in Malta with his wife and two French bulldogs. So let's find out a little bit more about Mark's varied career and what he's up to now. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really thrilled to talk to you.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
And I want to say, first of all, congratulations on the release of your debut novel, Fallout, and that was released May this year. So congratulations on that. That's a really big thing.
Yes.
Tell me about it. Tell the listeners about your book and who it's about.
Well, my background has been mainly film and television, and I decided it was time to try to create a franchise with the backdrop of movies. And I'm not comparing like for like, but in the same way that John Grisham uses law and the late Dick Francis used horse racing, although his son is continuing it, I thought it was time to try and write with some degree of knowledge a background in the film and television industry, which obviously I've been involved in for sort of 35 years. But the stories themselves, actually, although they always open in the film industry and not actually about, when you get to the end, you realize it's not about the film industry. So in this one, the story starts with a very successful screenwriter sending out 5 copies of his latest screenplay to a group of people. He is murdered in a break-in, and the 5 people who get the scripts were all involved in a movie that stopped shooting 25 years earlier. And they begin to understand slowly that inside his new blockbuster movie are clues as to what happened and to why that movie stopped being made. And the 2 lead protagonists is a producer and someone who builds stands down in Cannes, which is a huge business. And eventually they follow the leads and avoid getting murdered themselves. And the discovery of why the movie stopped shooting has got nothing to do with the movie industry. In fact, it's based on probably the greatest crime of the last century. But very few people know about it, so I'm not going to go into it anymore.
Oh, okay. Not many.
I was to read the book.
Yes, I will. I was thinking of The Great Train Robbery, but clearly not.
Oh, no. It was in current value, it was in the trillions.
Wow, okay. Oh, yes.
It's all historically correct. So I like to think that when you read the book, it's quite light. I wrote it, obviously, with the background of movies. It's very visual. And the dialogue is quite short and is whip smart, I hope. So it's very much like reading a movie. I brought all that knowledge of producing movies into writing the book. So hopefully, you know, it's an easy, fun, fast read, and in an environment that everybody thinks they know about, but they don't.
Got to get the behind the scenes. Oh, it does sound interesting. I really like it. And I love the cover. I think the cover is great as well.
Yes, that was designed by a lady in Ireland. It was wonderful.
It's lovely. Yeah, I'll put a link to that in the show notes so listeners can go and find it. Now, you've mentioned that you've worked in production, screenwriting in Hollywood. So you've made a number of pivots. In the introduction, I sort of outlined your background so people know that you've had quite a mixed background. So you started in the City of London with Lloyd's of London. So very pinstripe, very, I want to say rigid, but certainly very proper, shall we say, Lloyd's of London. But then you pivoted straight out of that into the madcap world of the Muppets and Jim Henson. So. Yeah. What made you want to make that move, and how did you make that pivot?
Well, within the confines of Lloyd's and insurance, what I was actually doing was very much on the raggedy edge. I did kidnap and ransom insurance. I did products extortion, i.e. when companies get rung up and people have infiltrated somewhere and put something nasty in their product. I used to do arms insurance for major arms manufacturers like General Motors. So I was always on the sort of raggedy edge of that business. And I was always considered a bit of a maverick in what I was doing. And it just happened that a guy that I shared an office with, his brother-in-law, worked for Jim Henson. And I'd always wanted to be involved in film and television, and I had no desire to spend the rest of my life wearing a suit and tie. And you know, in life, if you're persistent, it gets you a long way. And I was very persistent, and I got to know this guy who sadly has died now, a man called Peter Orton, very, very well. And he set me up with an interview with Jim Henson, and they were just starting a new company called Henson International Television. And they were just just finishing the Muppet Show and about to start on Fraggle Rock. And I got a job, and I never looked back. And although it was, you know, looking back, it's strange. But, you know, if you're the master of your own destiny, and without sounding arrogant, I've always walked to the beat of my own drum. As far as I'm concerned, I'm going forward. It's only when you look behind you and you see the zigzags right? As far as I was concerned, it was a logical step. I didn't want to be in the city anymore. And, you know, I went to work for the Muppets, which was very cool and great fun.
Very cool indeed, yes. I remember Fraggle Rock very well.
It's a very clever show, Fraggle Rock. And I'll tell you something that many of your listeners may not understand. Fraggle Rock is a jigsaw show. In fact, in the same way as Sesame Street. Now, if you're English, all the scenes underground require no lip sync, and it's just puppets. But when the character Gobo comes out of his hole, in the UK, it was originally Fulton Mackay in a lighthouse. But we reshot those scenes. So in France, it was a chef. In Germany, it was a garage mechanic. In United States, Canada, he was a beachcomber. Now, what happened then was that if you sew the pieces back together, if you have a French actor interrelating with Gobo, and then everything else, you don't require lip sync to dub it, the audience in France thought that show was 100% in France. And they won't believe you when they say, no, 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 it was all shot in Canada, which is where we did those sequences. So it was a very, very clever show, because for a broadcaster, all he had to reproduce is the costs of the scenes, as I said, with the hole. It was the same hole. And then introduce a different character. And then the postcards from Traveling Matt were shot in all the territories that we did those co-productions in. So it's a very, very clever show. And Sesame Street is the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, lovely. No. So that was the kind of pivot that you made right at the beginning. And then more recently, you've moved into the entrepreneurial space. Because I'm guessing that when you were working for the Muppets and Jim Henson and then Hallmark and some of the other big companies, you know, that was sort of corporate, very, very corporate. So now you've moved into the kind of more entrepreneurial space. And you've co-founded a CBD producer called Dragonfly Biosciences, as well as two separate digital companies. So I was really interested in this, particularly the CBD Dragonfly Biosciences. What's drawn you to, first of all, to that, and then also to entrepreneurship?
Well, I think, I mean, if I go back a little bit on what you said, in the terms of entertainment industry, I wasn't really that... Again, like I was, like in Lloyd's, I wasn't really that conservative. I never worked for a major like Warner's or Disney. I never worked for a network. I was always an independent producer in the sense that I wasn't part of a major outfit. And in fact, the reason I got into writing a book is that when you make a movie or a television show, it's very collaborative. Whereas if you write a book, there's only one person to blame. As for the Dragonfly, I mean, it's in Boots and Tesco's and Harrods and Sainsbury's and God knows where. That came about. I just finished a miniseries for Universal and Sky called Neverland, which was the backstory of Peter Pan, with all sorts of people in it, Emma Friel and Risa fans. In fact, they met on that set and they fell in love. Bob Hoskins was in it because he was recreating the role of Smee he did for Spielberg. Anyway, I finished that. I was in Los Angeles and a friend of mine who was also a producer who produced the movie The Butler and I, we were having lunch and he was talking about, you know, marijuana and all this stuff and, you know, he'd like to export it into Europe. And I knew nothing about it. I said, Charles, you're out of your mind. They're not going to regulate. They're not going to criminalize it. And I didn't think very much of it. But I spoke to another friend of mine who just sold his business for a couple of hundred million to John Malone. He was a very successful cable and satellite operator. And he was looking for something to do. And I said, hey, listen, you know, why don't you talk to my friend, blah, blah, blah. And I left it alone. And about 6 months later, I rang him. And he said, listen, I think there's something in this. The only thing I don't understand is why on earth would we buy stuff grown in America when we can do it for a tenth of the price if we do it in Europe? nobody knew what CBD was then. So we all threw some money in and blind as bats and full of hope, we jumped off a cliff. And I don't know, we harvested last year nearly 2,000 acres.
Wow.
It's probably 500,000 kilos. And I think we're the biggest now in Europe. And it was just something different. I mean, you can either say it's a plus or a minus. I've never actually done the same thing for more than 5 or 6 years. And even when I worked in film and television, I was involved in records for a while. I had Nana Cherry, for example. I worked in TV production, then TV distribution. Then I ended up buying the Hallmark Channel internationally, so I became a network owner. Then I went back to producing. Then I wrote a book. Then I did. So that's kind of who I am. I'm sure I'd be a lot richer if I'd stuck at the same thing, but I'd be bored.
Exactly. It wouldn't be as much fun, would it?
No. It wouldn't be as much fun.
So you've, as you mentioned, you know, you've done a lot of different mini series and TV series. And I'm just wondering, yeah, just kind of thinking about the entrepreneurship, when you start a new project, a new TV or film project, is that like starting a new startup? It's a new cast, yeah, a new crew.
It's very, very similar. It's very similar. I mean, look, it, and I'm not talking exclusively here because it depends who you are. You know, if you're a major talent like a writer, director, a showrunner, who are the people who really control Hollywood now because all the money's in television, not movies, you can dictate terms and get things made. But I was just, you know, one of lots of what they call executive producers, and my role was to find a project, package it, finance it, and as soon as the money was in place, I would kind of step back. In fact, in the book Fallout, there's a scene where two of them are saying, she's talking about reading credits, saying, I've never understood the difference between executive producer, producer, associate producer, co-producer. And he goes through and explains it to her in a very funny way, I hope. But as an executive producer, that's what I used to do. So, for example, on Treasure Island with Eddie Izzard, I did for Sky. The starting point was, I think Eddie would make a great Silver. And it started from there. And then we put it together a bit, went to Sky, and they were interested and they put up some money. And then we went to, again, Universal in the United States, and they put up a bit of money. And then we financed some of it ourselves through tax deals, and that's how it goes.
A lot of problem solving.
Yeah, it's very much like start, and it has the same success rate. You know, you know, you've only got to bat 51. You know, you don't have to bat 100. It's very similar.
Mm-hmm. So I think from that we've gotten a real great sense of how varied your working life has been, how you've tried so many different things, and you've got a lot of things going on at the one time.
Yeah.
And I know that one of the things that my audience tells me they battle with a lot of the time is managing all the things, you know, how do you fit in writing around a paid job, around family, around a social life? So how do you manage all of the other things that are going? Because I know that you love doing adventure sports and you live a very active life. So how do you fit everything in and then manage to squeeze in that solitary time to do your writing?
Well, as someone who's totally undisciplined, I'm afraid it boils down to discipline. You know, there's always the time if you are willing to sacrifice doing something else. Now, that's easy to say when my kids are all grown up and everything, and I understand it's very difficult. But the truth of the matter is, where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, look at J.K. Rowling. She came out of an unhappy marriage. She started writing it in a coffee shop, the Harry Potter books. Plenty of other writers come with all sorts of monkeys on their back. I think the truth is you just have to face the hard fact that you've got to do it. I mean, I hate writing. I love editing. I hate writing. And when I am writing, I've got the cleanest nails, the most polished shoes, the cleanest office, anything other than actually having to face a blank page. But the truth of the matter is it doesn't write itself. You have to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, people have different methods of doing it, which, you know, might make a difference. I don't start with a skeleton and build it out. I'm as in the dark as the reader is when I start a book. I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. I have a rough idea what the MacGuffin is, and that's about it.
Okay.
So, you know, in the back of my mind when I'm writing, without overdoing it, I always say to myself, okay, what's the most unexpected thing that you would expect to happen now? Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. There's a bit of a reverse tautology, but that's what I try and do. Also, I find that subconscious is an amazing thing. You put in little details about something. You're not quite sure why you've put it in. And then as I got closer to the denouement in the book, there was a whole load of stuff that hooked up together that I had no understanding why I put them in. Huh. But it made sense when I got to the end. So don't fight the subconscious. It's a really great asset. And I suppose the only other thing from my point of view, as I said, I hate writing. I love editing. You just got to plow on and get to the end of that sentence or that paragraph. Even if you know it doesn't work, put it down. Because for me, it's much easier to edit something that's not very good than mm-hmm. to stare at a blank piece of paper.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you have to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's just for me. I mean, for other people, it could be something totally different. But most writers, most professional writers, you know, I say that very loosely, but you could talk about, you know, Jeffrey Archer or who's the American guy who sells God knows how many bloody books. Any of those writers, usually they set aside and are very disciplined. They'll write from 8 to 12. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then they won't write for the rest of the day. Some people do a little bit more. Some people do less. Some people are regular. Some people are irregular. I used to, if I put aside some time to write, I was lucky. I didn't have to go into an office or anything. And sometimes I would write for 2 days. Sometimes I'd write for 2 hours.
Because that was going to be a question. Yeah, when you are writing, yeah. What does that routine look like? But it sounds like it's not a specific routine.
It's very fluid. Mm-hmm. It's very, but that's just for me. I mean, you can't presume to understand how everybody else, you know, what their rhythm is. Mine's very irregular. But again, from years of being involved in film and television, I'm very used to writing certain things in a linear sense and then stopping and changing chapters around and moving things around. I mean, in the movies, you basically work on something called a three-act paradigm. So nearly every movie you see has three acts. The first act can be only 5-10 minutes, and it has a telescope of time. Usually it can go over an enormous period of time. The second act, which is the bulk of the movie, is chasing the heroes up the tree, whether it's an emotional tree or an action tree or whatever. That's the second paradigm, and it's spread over a slightly more compressed time. And then the third act of the paradigm is the denouement. It's nearly always current time.
Right, okay.
And that's how most movies are written, unless you're Quentin Tarantino, who was the first person to break the three-act paradigm. And if you look at his movies, they are actually linear. It's just the way that he cuts them up when he's writing them. So if you look at Pulp Fiction and it opens with the honey bunny scene, you know, in that restaurant, that's actually the end of the movie. So what he did was, instead of keeping the three-act paradigm together and changing the chapters within those acts, he would move them from one to the third act.
Right,
and that's okay. Basically how I would write. I'd try and keep them to the paradigms, although my paradigms were parts of the book. So if I had five parts of the book, I'd usually keep them within those five and move them around. But sometimes I'd move something from book one or part one to part four, if it made sense.
This is with the TV stuff, your TV scripts.
If I'm writing a book now, I would usually follow the three-act paradigm formula, which is within those acts, those scenes, you change them around. Except when you're writing a book, it's not a three-act paradigm. It's usually done by the actual parts of the book, if you see what I mean. So usually I would change things around in parts of the book to see if that would make the narrative more interesting. But sometimes I would pull out a chapter from the opening of the book and put it in part five. But usually I kept within the books. But I never, never, never ended up with any chapters in the place that I wrote them.
Okay.
They all moved around, which is very complicated when you come to a thriller with clues, because it's kind of Da Vinci-esque in the way that the clues are revealed, et cetera, et cetera. So that's incredibly irritating, because if you move things around too much, then the whole thing comes undone. So you have to be careful with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, because I was interested when you were saying before that you don't plot it out in advance. And so as someone who's writing a murder story, a mystery story, I would have imagined that'd be quite a key part of the process, so that you know when you are seeding clues, when you're doing the foreshadowing, and that you yourself know how it's going to end. But it sounds like you're more of a discovery writer, and you sort of see where it goes.
I am a discovery writer. I mean, I knew various, obviously, otherwise you just go off into the desert and you just, you know, you drive yourself insane. But much more than, again, without sort of sounding pretentious, if you read the book, you wouldn't guess it.
Right,
you just
okay.
go, this flows and that's clever. And yes, it flips through time a bit. There are basically three storylines going on that interweave and then all meet at the end. But I hope you won't think it was disjointed when you read it, but it was when it was being put together. It was definitely knit one, purl one, stitch one.
So what was my, I had a question that came into my head there. Oh, is it gone now? Yes, I wanted to ask you about dialogue. So obviously coming from a screenwriting background, I imagine that you're, as you alluded to earlier, very good with dialogue, very sharp with it, know how to write it. Did you find it more of a learning curve when it came to doing the narrative bits of the story to fill in those bits around the dialogue? Because I don't think scripts have very much exposition in them or direction in them.
They do a bit, and you'll see it in here because there are excerpts from the screenplay that the guy wrote, and it's printed like you would print a screenplay, if you see what
okay.
I mean. So it's completely different from a book. You do have directions on scripts, yes. I suppose if there's one thing I brought with me is that, first of all, great dialogue is usually short. Secondly, great scenes with dialogues, certainly in movies and television, you come into the scene as late as possible. You very, very rarely set up a dialogue, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You're usually coming in on the back of the dialogue. And thirdly, you know, it's a cliche, and I'll come on to the descriptive bits in a minute, but it's a cliche, but character is action.
Okay.
Who the person is action. There's a great example in Chinatown. When Jack Nicholson is sitting in the car with Faye Dunaway and she's telling him she's having an affair with Houston, who plays her father. Now, in the original script, Nicholson is just sitting there listening to this. But Jack decided to take out a cigarette with a lighter that didn't light. And suddenly that scene took on much more edge because he's listening to something that you realize he doesn't want to listen to, and his frustration is being taken out as he repeatedly tries to light the cigarette. So that character is action in that scene. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you have to bear that in mind when you're writing dialogue. As for exposition, obviously try not to use too many adjectives. Keep it short. It's a trick. You can overwrite and then edit back,
mm-hmm.
and choose the right adjective. The pace of the sentence often reflects the actual scene that you're looking at. So if it's something peaceful and quiet, you can write in a more lyrical way. If you're describing an action scene or a fight scene, it's short, sharp, and choppy. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Yes. Yes, it does.
And that's how you should do it. There's a rhythm to how you read. A lot of people say there's a rhythm how writers write. I'm not sure. I'm sure that's true. But the reality is that the rhythm should match the environment of what you're reading. That's true rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back on all the days I've been so rude to writers in my life, and I apologize to all of them now, because it's unbelievably hard, and how some of them did what they did is beyond me. I'd never have the skill to do it. But again, it just depends on what you're writing. Obviously, thrillers are different from a romance, are different from a pure action, are different, or even from a biography or whatever, a memoirs. But rhythm in your sentences must match the environment.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that as well, that's something that comes with practice, part of the craft that comes over time, and you just have to keep doing your 1,000 hours, your 10,000 hours, you know, where you have to put in the groundwork first before you're able to fully understand that or fully communicate it with the language that you're using.
Yeah, I think it's all to do, as I said, in my case, it's all to do with the edit. It doesn't really matter what you throw down to start with. It's like a piece of clay. You just throw it down and you roughly make it into a face or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The craft comes later when you pare that down, when you edit it down, when you pull it back to the basics, and then you'll get a sense of, as I said, if sentences are too long or it's too descriptive,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously try and avoid as much exposition as possible because people hate it, and it slows everything down. Also, it's how you talk to the reader. In my case, I was hoping to do it with a wry smile, but also make them feel inclusive to the film and television industry,
mm-hmm.
so that they would go, "Oh, I never understood that," rather than feel I was making a reveal because I'm more intelligent than they are. Do you understand what I mean?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You've got to have that, but it depends. It depends how you do it. Sherlock Holmes permanently made Holmes feel inferior. In my book, the two characters, one's a man and one's a woman, they complement each other, which is quite unusual because usually in a thriller, you have one whose superior intellect is drawn out by a less intelligent partner or... Mm-hmm. In this case, because it's also a love story, you are permanently battling with how they complement each other and they make the other a better person.
Okay.
So when you're doing a romance, which is all about making usually, both of them better people than they were on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you do that in a thriller environment, you can't have one being more intelligent than the other. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. They've got to be good partners, equal partners, both professionally and in life.
Professionally. But you can get away with it professionally. You can get away with, you know, Poirot and whatever his name, Captain Hastings or whatever. You can do that. But you can't, but first of all, it's very, you know, it's slightly old fashioned now. But secondly, you can't do it when there's a relationship between the people. And, you know, the woman in this book, the heroine is a Chinese American lady who's very strong, much stronger than the guy is actually originally. She's very tough and she's very smart, and they have cracking dialogue between them. I mean, even I laugh, which, you know, it's not that hard. Somebody's got to. But I hope that makes some degree of sense.
It does. No, it's, I like it. And I think it's, I'm guessing, I'm not, I like thrillers, but I'm not a hugely knowledgeable about the genre. But I'm guessing that element of having both the personal, the romance between the partners, as well as the working relationship, is quite a nice spin on it, that it's slightly more unusual telling.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I think there's a number of things going on here. But, you know, if you're looking for a similar sort of feel and tempo, I suppose the remake, The Thomas Crown Affair, is quite good, right? Uh-huh. The relationship between René Russo and Piers, both of whom worked for me at some time. Now, it's very interesting that because of COVID, there is a massive sea change going on in the thriller genre, in that essentially from Seven onwards, thrillers became very dark. You had a very damaged hero, mm-hmm. right? The journey was very painful, and the crimes on the whole were pretty dark. It was mass murder, kids, abduction, drugs, obviously. It was very, very dark. And it's interesting to note that when that started was the last Lethal Weapon movie. You just couldn't do that kind of lightness of touch anymore. Now, interestingly, the one of the most successful movies on Netflix was a movie with Jennifer Aniston, which was a sort of caper movie in the south of France, with a very well-known comedian whose name escapes me now. Nobody thought anything of it, but it was a huge success. And
which one was that?
It's called Riviera. I can't remember it. I can't remember. It's a silly little caper movie with the guy who should have got an Oscar nomination, Adam Sandler. It sent all sorts of tremors through Hollywood because it showed that we were coming to the end of a very dark period of thrillers. And I'm proved right because they've just signed the next Lethal Weapon movie.
Wow,
with
okay.
Danny and Mel have agreed to do it. It just wouldn't have happened 5 years ago. Just that. So that leitmotif, I'm not saying my book is like Lethal Weapon, although it is quite, in fact, we're talking to the guy who wrote the screenplay for the Thomas Crown Affair, because I've optioned this to do it as a series, to see if he'll write it as a 10-hour series. But there is a change going on at the moment, and I was lucky because I just happened to write something that was kind of light and funny a bit, but that's just lucky timing. But I think the very dark, very introspective stuff is coming to an end. It's just okay. A cycle.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So what made you make the move from writing scripts to writing novels? What was it that attracted you about?
I didn't write scripts. As a producer, I'd work on the scripts.
Right, okay.
I wasn't able to write a script. I think, as I mentioned, I think it's because working on film and television are very collaborative. And unless you're, you know, Steven Spielberg or somebody, you know, or in television, one of the great showrunners, you don't get your way. You have to compromise all the time. Well, that's a good thing, but it's also, you know, after a while you go, well, actually I want to do it myself. And the only way to do something yourself is write a book, you know.
Yes, just get on and do it.
You've got no one else to blame but yourself.
Yes, that's it. So you've mentioned that it's part of a series. So the first one came out this year, and I think you are currently working on number two?
Not enough, but I am, yes. I've put myself, you know, in a very difficult position because I put the first three chapters of the next book in the last book.
Uh-huh.
So now I'm really stuck. I've got to do it.
So what's it
again,
called?
I know what the ostensive crime is within the film industry, and I know what the backstory crime is. So I've got that in place.
Is it the same characters?
Two of the same characters, the man and the woman, return. Although there are some characters who do survive in Fallout that I would love to bring back, and I'm sure I will. And the locations are set. I have a thing about location. So the first book was Los Angeles, London, just outside Interlaken and the Philippines. And this book is going to be the Aleutian Islands, which are off the, they like a string of pearls going across to Russia and from Canada or Alaska.
Ooh, lovely.
So the Aleutian Islands, San Francisco, the countryside in France and Malta.
Lovely. Well, that fits in kind of nicely with all the traveling that you've done, bringing in all those lovely places you've been to. Yay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's called The Bastion, is that right?
The Bastion, yeah.
And do we have an expected date for that release yet, or are you playing it by ear?
No, I've been a bit busy at work recently, so I would like to deliver it sometime next year.
Fantastic. You know, we'll look forward
to that. Probably end of the summer next year. It just depends when I can, deflect from my other interests.
And do you envisage it being an ongoing series?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
It's written as a franchise.
Lovely.
Those two characters will keep on coming back, and they will keep on getting drawn into something that happened on the movie they were making, financing, writing, asked to help on, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so the, you know, in a similar way to more like, I'm not talking about Star, but more like Francis, that there was always something about horse racing sort of in the background, but they weren't about horse racing all the time. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So it's the same thing here. Yeah, you get an insight into movies, and hopefully, you know, because I've used some real people from movies in the book, being nice enough to say fine. So when you're reading it, it should be very difficult to split reality from fiction.
Ooh.
Because when you're reading about the Cannes Film Festival, which I've done more times than you want to shake a stick at, you know, a lot of that is real because that's what it's like. So when you read it, you go, did that happen at the film festival or not? Because that person's real and that movie was real, but I'm not sure about that bit. And that's hopefully the fun of the book.
So that's interesting. So I've got two follow-up questions to that. One is, so you've written this, you know it's a series, you always knew you wanted it to be optioned and to be a franchise. So I'm guessing you had at least the two main characters in mind who might play those parts when you were writing it. And I wondered if you are able to share that with us.
Funnily enough, I didn't, except... you know, if you want to be very cynical about writing and you want to get something made, you have to accept what target groups you're writing to. So the male protagonist is probably in his early 40s. The woman is probably in her mid-30s.
Okay.
So that was it uppermost in my mind. As the characters, no, I didn't. I think if touch wood, it ever gets turned into a TV series, books are impossible to do as movies. I've done a few and it's very difficult. But if it's done as a 10-hour series, I'm certain that we will probably have a shortlist of cast, and the guy who writes the screenplay will skew what I've written towards a specific actor.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that happens. But I didn't know. I didn't write it with anybody in mind. I mean, you know, sometimes people do. I mean, there's a great story, isn't there, about twins, which was an idea by a guy from the Mail who flew to Hollywood. And so I've got this movie about twins. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. And he sold it on that. They hadn't even asked them yet, right? But that doesn't happen very often.
That's brilliant. But my second follow-up question is,
yes.
You've mentioned that you mentioned real people, real movies, real things that have gone on. Did you have to be careful about what you said about who and what you used? Because I know that's something a lot of people worry about, is this kind of idea of libel and being sued about something and using real people in their stories. Is that something
I can't say who it is because it'll give away some of the MacGuffin. But some of the references to real people actually come from books that they wrote about themselves. You see what I mean?
Okay. So it's out there already.
Putting them in a situation. Yeah. Yeah. Movies are different because you can refer and relate to movies. And, you know, there's a line they're talking about the protagonists. I think they're in bed probably at the time, but they're talking about, or she says, all movies are the same to me. And then he says, well, there's only five stories anyway, which is quite well known. And she said, yeah, but they all sound the same to me. And he said, do you know what the most popular line in a movie is? And she goes, you know, that's all, folks. He goes, no, and there's that. And it's actually, try and get some rest.
Is it?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Trivial Pursuit.
It's not I love you. Let's
try and get some rest.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really looking
for you ever see.
I will. I'll be looking out for it now. Yes. Well, I think they sound fascinating. I'm as someone who has sort of has an interest in Hollywood and loves to follow all that kind of thing and the background and how it all works, I'm really looking forward to reading them. And I can think of a few people who will be getting that as a Christmas present this year. So that's cool.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. And I hope they enjoy it. I hope they enjoy it. And thank you for your time.
Not a problem. Now, before you go, tell us where can listeners find out more about you and your books?
Well, I have a website, www.mngrenside.com. And the book is actually under MN Grenside rather than Mark. And it's available on Amazon and shops and goodness knows what else. The website has details about me personally, and it has details about my life and things that interest me. There's some fairly amusing photographs from various, from skydiving to racing cars to, I don't know, all sorts of stuff. My wife plucked them out. She's braver than I am. I spend my life jumping out of planes following her. Yeah, I do like adventure. I love travel. I love cooking cars, as you mentioned, cars from the 50s, 60s and 70s, and good friends.
It's nice. All the important things, the important things. Well, that's lovely. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed listening to you and your stories. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And you're welcome anytime. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mark Grenside, and I hope you've been inspired to read the book. I loved listening to his anecdotes about Hollywood and the movie business and how things work behind the scenes. But in terms of writing, my biggest takeaway from what he said today was that character is action. And I love the example he gave with Jack Nicholson in Chinatown and how it's what a character does, their mannerisms, how they respond to a situation physically, not necessarily with words. But when we get that from the character, then we're really seeing below the surface. We're seeing the depths of the character and what's going on behind the eyes, behind the words, behind the voice. So I really love that. That was my biggest takeaway from my conversation with Mark, certainly in terms of writing fiction. What was your biggest takeaway? What has he managed to convey to you that's really resonated with you and that you'll take forward in your own writing life? Hit the comments below and let me know. All right, take care for now, and I will see you again next time. Bye.